Terrific job. Wasn't that great? Been telling you for years there's a lot in that Andy Griffith, Barney Fife stuff, huh? Barney, how many bullets did he have? Where did he have to keep it? In his pocket. And every time he brought it out, he was shooting himself in the foot or somebody else. Dangerous little character. Great lessons in him. He's a guy whose heart was always generally right, but his pride always kept him from being effectively used. And so it is so often in Christian life. But I've never heard of the doctrine of Barney Fife. I'm going to have to go upstairs after this service, get in my office and bury myself for a little while, get into ISBE and maybe see if I can find anything on the doctrines of Barney Fife. Guys, you can bring the screen down. About, I don't know how many years ago it was, probably 12, 15 years ago, Lord gave me a message called From Shepherd Boy to a King. And that was one of my favorite messages. I don't know why. You know, you have some messages that stick out, things that you remember about them, and that's one of them. I only preached it twice. I preached it one time here. Matter of fact, I was pastoring in Lockport at the time and was here for a Bible conference. I think I preached it here during one of the Bible conferences. Preached it one other time in Tennessee. Terrific message there, Sharon. So you got to promise me you will sing that song again, okay? Great message in that. I want you to do that. All right, when we left off, we were dealing with the life of Abraham, and he was preparing to sacrifice his son Isaac. And we talked a little bit about this in detail, and that God provided a ram, and he was spared this horrible price of his son, and the ram there caught in the thicket. Abraham proved his faith again to God, and shortly thereafter, we read about, as we mentioned last week, they came down from the mount there, and then the situation where Sarah died, and we're shortly going to be dealing with the death of Abraham as well. But Abraham's pretty much out of the picture at this time. And Isaac, of course, follows in his footsteps. And Isaac is going to take a wife. And I'm not sure if I've got a map in here or not. I'm going to fumble my way through. No, we're going to jump ahead to Jacob and Esau. But when Isaac prepares to take a wife, Abraham comes to his servant and he tells the servant, I want you to go back up to Haran and take a wife for my son Isaac. And if you recall this story, Abraham's servant, Eliezer, traveled way up to the city of Haran, long journey, and there took a wife, whose name was Rebekah, for Isaac, and brought her back. And it's a very interesting story, all the things that took place during that time. But eventually they made their way down. It's a great love story. A lot of women sort of like this one because here she comes. She's been chosen to be the bride of this very special individual who in many ways is very wealthy and comes from the family of a man who was chosen of God with a specific mission in mind. And there she travels a long journey and she comes to this strange country and then she lights off of a camel and there's Isaac walking through the field, you know, meditating in the evening tide and the two meet for the first time and their eyes meet and, you know, and all that stuff goes on, you know. That anyway, they end up getting married and living happily ever after or somewhat. Rebecca was, she was a personality in her own right, which we'll see in a few moments. But in time, they would give birth to twin boys by the name of Jacob and Esau. And the story of Jacob and Esau is really quite detailed. These two boys, even though twins, were very different in every respect. Esau was a sort of a manly kind of fella. He was born very hairy, the scriptures tell us. And his very name, Esau, means red, and he was a red-skinned. But he was an individual that most of the men in this building could identify with. He was a bowman, a hunter, and all that stuff. On the other hand, Jacob was a mama's boy. And he was pampered a bit by his mother. He was the favorite of his mother. We would call him a sissy, and maybe rightfully so. They were just very different, these two young men. But there was one thing about Jacob that you have to appreciate, and that is that he did put a certain amount of spiritual value about inner things, things that were important. For instance, his birthright. In this picture that you see here, Esau has gone out hunting one day and he didn't have much luck. And he comes back and he's famished. He is starving to death. And there is Jacob and he's cooking up a pot of of pottage, actually. And before it's all over, Esau sells his birthright as the firstborn son for a bowl of pottage. Now, it should have been worth more than that, but it wasn't to Esau. He didn't put a very high value on things like this. And so God was very displeased with Esau. Jacob sort of became the spiritual one, if you will. Later would become a great man. But much like Abraham, Jacob did not start out as a great man. He's a very famous individual in the Bible. When I said the name Jacob, most of you knew who he was. But the truth is, Jacob was not a great man in his early days. He became a great man in his latter days, just like his grandfather Abraham. Well, this situation caused a little bit of a rift between these boys. Finally, the day is coming when Isaac, their father, is getting ready to die, and he says that it's time to bless one of his sons, and of course he's going to bless his firstborn son Esau. Well, in the meantime, Jacob, whose name means supplanter, is listening, and actually his mother is listening in the background. She overhears this conversation, and she goes and gets Jacob. She says, "Jacob, listen, here's what's getting ready to happen. Your dad is getting ready to bless Esau, and you're my favorite. You're my little sweetie pie. You're my little darling, and you're the little boy after my own heart. We just can't have this. Esau, he's so rough and crude, and I know your daddy likes him, but the fact is, we got to do something here." And so Rebecca was a bit of a conniver herself. And she says, "Let's do this. Esau's out there hunting. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go and grab us a goat and skin this thing and pretend like we've got some venison. We're going to bring it to your dad. He's blind. He's blind as a bat anyway. He can't see anything. We can pull this thing off." Esau's scared to death. He's thinking, "How in the world am I going to do this?" Esau's hairy. You know, he's got hair all over. You know, I mean, he's hairy. I don't know what else to say about Esau. He was so hairy that Jacob had to take goat skin and put it on the back of his neck, so that when his father touched him back there, he'd know it was Esau. That's hairy, folks. I mean, that's scary kind of hairy. I mean, that is the Bigfoot out in California or something. I'm not sure. Well, anyway, they do pull this little scheme off. And Jacob does, in fact, go out and take a goat, skin it, and he dresses up and comes before his father. And he does succeed in convincing his father that he is Esau. And even though Isaac was a bit suspicious, he was pretty much blind at this point. He couldn't see, but he could hear pretty well. And he knew the voice was not right. But when he put his hand out, and he felt, they put goat skin on his hands here too, and he felt that, and he felt back here, and, well, it sure feels like Esau, and he made the decision to go ahead and bless the wrong son, and the blessing fell upon the second born son. But remember, the birthright had been sold previous to this. It was all a part of the plan. And Jacob became the blessed son who then would be honored by his father. And this caused even more of a rift. Matter of fact, Esau was so angry at Jacob that he decided he was going to kill him. Jacob's mommy, Rebecca, she didn't want her little boy being killed, so she intervened again. She says, "You've got to run for your life because Esau's going to kill you. And it's time for you to go and take a wife. I mean, you're a man now. He's 40 years of age. It's about time for you to get up and out of the household and make it on your own, kid." But anyway, he does. He heads up. He is sent up north to Haran again, the same place that Isaac went to get his wife. Well, while he's going there, he has a dream. Now, he gets up, I think, as far as Bethel and up in that area, and he's heading up way, way north. He's on a long journey. And while he's there one night all by himself, getting ready to turn in for the night, camping. Now, I don't know if you ever camped out by yourself. Anybody ever camped out by yourself out in the wilderness? A few of you have. It's a different kind of experience. I've done it on an occasion or two, particularly growing up. I remember one time camping out back in the woods behind our house, and a screech owl. You ever heard a screech owl? I mean, it sounds like somebody's being murdered when those things go off. And I remember hearing that thing, and I knew what it was because I grew up in those woods, and it still scared me. But there he was that night, all by himself, on a long journey away from home. Never would see his family again. Never would see his mother again. And he is turning in for the night, and he has a dream. And the dream that he has is a very unusual dream. You can see these are angels ascending and descending on a virtual ladder that goes up into heaven. And if you will, it's sort of a gateway between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdoms of this world, between the physical and the spiritual. I believe personally that that's a doctrinal thing. I believe that gateway exists because angels do cross over on a regular basis from the physical into the spiritual. We've seen that throughout the Bible. And even the New Testament affirms the fact that we entertain angels unawares. When angels appear in the physical realm, they appear just like men. They don't have flapping wings. There's nothing about their outward appearance that would tell you or I that they were an angel, except perhaps our spiritual discernment. But these are angels ascending and descending, and Jacob has this vision, this dream that night, and God speaks to him. And it was a part of God establishing a personal relationship with Jacob, a personal relationship that would continue to grow as time went along. Well, Jacob then continues his journey up north, and he is heading up, and I use this map so this little green area here is the land of Israel, so that you could see Haran. I doubt that you can read it, but if you go up to the top of that green area, when it starts to make the turn and heading down this direction, is where the city of Haran is. When we started this series a few weeks ago, I told you, remember Haran, because we would journey back there several times, because that's where Abraham's brother settled down. And Abraham's family, at least bloodline, continued up in that area. And when it's time for his boys to take wives, that's where they were sent, back there, rather than taking the inhabitants of the land who did not know the ways of God. And therefore, Jacob has traveled up into the city of Haran. There he will meet his wife. He gets up there and he finds this beautiful young lady. He sees her, and I'm telling you, when he lays eyes on her, he realizes this gal is a knockout. She's a beautiful young lady. Her name is Rachel. And he sort of makes a deal with Rachel's daddy. His name is Laban. He was a conniving character himself. Makes a deal with Laban, says, I'll tell you what we'll do. You know, we'll work this thing out. And he's going to work 7 years. 7 years he's going to work for this bride-to-be. Any of you guys in here worked 7 years so that you could lay claim to your prize, your bride-to-be? That's quite a sacrifice, isn't it? And of course, most of you know the story. What an awful thing happened to this poor guy. He works for 7 years on his wedding night. As the Jewish tradition was, you know, they had their tent set aside to consummate the marriage and all this. And boy, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. When he woke up in the morning, wrong girl. He ended up being giving Rachel's sister. Her name was Leah. Shocker, man. I mean, when the daylight hit. And you say, how could something like that happen? Well, they were sisters. Number two, the veil and all of that stuff. Number three, they didn't have like electricity in those tents, to my knowledge. And so I'm sure it was quite dark. All in all, bad scene. Jacob was not a happy puppy the next morning. This was not pleasing him. I'll tell you, somebody else wasn't happy. Rachel was none too happy either. She had lost her husband-to-be. And so then Jacob, because of his great love for Rachel, said, I'll serve you for another 7 years. And he did. He worked for another 7 years as a servant so that he could earn the right to marry Rachel. And of course, in the meantime, he was still married to Leah. And now he's got sisters. That's a double trouble. And if you don't believe it was double trouble, just continue reading in the scriptures. It was double trouble. Those two sisters learned to hate each other in a marvelous fashion. Jealousy. And then the jealousy even got worse when Rachel could not bear children. She couldn't conceive. And so she says to Jacob, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you one of my handmaids as a wife, and you have children by her. And Jacob readily agreed. Next thing you know, he's got three wives. And then Leah jumps on the bandwagon. She says, well, two can play this game. So she gives her handmaid. Next thing you know, Jacob's got four wives. And things are hopping around there. Now there's this jealousy, and kids are being born, and you know, there's jealousy over who has the most kids and who's getting the most attention, and not a household that most of us would have felt real comfortable in. Well, that was Jacob's life. I'm glad. I mean, I love my wife, but I'm glad there's only one of her. You know what I'm saying? She's a sweet gal, she really is, but one woman is enough. And poor old Jacob, ended up with four. Life was not so pleasant for him, and he serves up there. He ends up spending 20 years there in Iran, 20 years working mostly as a servant. And of course, at one point in time, he's given a herd that he works for another 6 years after his previous 14 years. And now he begins to build his herd, and God comes to him and says, "It's time for you to leave. I want you to head back south." And of course, he is up in Haran, up in that northern region. He's going to head back down into this southern region here of Israel, back in the area of Bethel, where Abraham had originally settled. So he's getting ready to head back, and then lo and behold, the thought occurs to him, and there's a reason for this, that he's going to have to deal with Esau. Esau's still down there. Matter of fact, worse than that, he hears that Esau is coming to meet him. Now we really got a situation. Here he is with his four wives. He's got 12 sons. Actually, one is going to be unborn on the way, but he'll have 12 sons and one daughter by the name of Dinah. So there's 13 kids involved, and he has a tremendous herds, flocks, and servants that are coming back with him. And as he's journeying down, he hears that his brother Esau, who's the one he fled the country for in the first place, is going to meet him, and he knows what's going to happen. Esau is going to kill him. Esau's going to kill him. He's going to kill all of his family. Esau's that big hairy guy, the Bigfoot from Israel, and he's going to destroy me and everything that I love. So as he's journeying down there, he sort of separates himself from his family. And there one night, again, he goes to bed by himself. And this time sort of chooses to do this. And he has a dream and a vision and an angel. We believe to be the angel of the Lord shows up. And he actually wrestles with this angel that night. And they're going back and forth wrestling. And something about Jacob, you know, for all of his bad things, his conniving spirit, his sissified ways, his supplanting methods, stealing the birthright, and all of the things that he did, there was something about him, because the scripture said that he was found to have power with God. So he had power with God. We put a lot of emphasis these days upon athletics, being a real man, you know, and I like all those things. I really do. But I think spiritual power with God is the most important thing that any man can have. It's far more important than being 6'6" and weighing 240 pounds or 50 pounds and playing, you know, professional football. I mean, that's an okay thing. That's a very manly thing. But I'd rather have power with God. Any day. And Jacob had that. At least he was developing that. And so that night, he wrestled with his angel. A real strange situation. He ended up getting his hip joint messed up. And he walked with a limp. He halted the rest of his life, one of these things. And it was some sayings came forth from that as a result. But the bottom line of it is, he lived the rest of his days with the injury he had that night wrestling with the angel of the Lord. But he's found to have power with God. Well, anyway, he crosses over the river. And, of course, he still hasn't quite got it all together. When he sets things up here, remember, he's got four wives, four sets of kids. And he puts them in groups. And he takes the ones that he doesn't like the most. And he puts them out front. And then he takes the second group and he puts them there. And then he takes Leah and puts her third with her kids. And then Rachel, his beloved, he puts her last, you know, to protect her. Maybe he'll kill off all the rest of them and, you know, she'll be the last one to die. And that's the way he's thinking here. But the fact is, when he meets Esau, and it's sort of a humorous story, because Esau likes, I mean, they come rushing at one another. And you see Jacob, I mean, he falls down like, you know, he's getting ready to beg for forgiveness. And the fact is, Esau is happy to see him, his long-lost brother. And you can almost envision Jacob going, you know, he thought surely he was going to die. And as it turned out, Esau was happy to see him, and they sort of get reunited. But Jacob's still afraid of him, because as they make plans for the both of them to continue down into the land, he says, well, let's travel, or Esau says, let's travel together. Jacob says, nah, you go ahead. We got the women, we got the cattle, we need to take our time. So Esau agrees, and he heads on down here and goes over into the land of Edom, right in this region, expecting Jacob to follow along. Jacob says, nah, I don't trust him. And so he follows, and he stops right about here, and he settles in this area, and then the two are never really united again. But Jacob We'll see more about him as he continues in his personal relationship with God. But he is, at least at this point, reunited with Esau. There are a number of little things that happen in their lives. Dinah is defiled by some of the inhabitants of the land, and a couple of the sons of Jacob, Levi and Simeon, really pull off a devious act, and there's some time in the scriptures given to that. But the fact is, things pretty much settle out, and the boys are all living in this territory right in southern Israel at this time. Their herds are getting bigger. They are becoming a very powerful family in many ways. I don't know if they own land, but they are letting their sheep travel long distances. Matter of fact, when we pick the story up again, the brothers have traveled all the way up into this region up here to an area around the city of Dothan. And there they have their sheep in the pastures. And one day, Jacob says to his second youngest son, whose name was Joseph, who was also the son of Rachel. Rachel had two children. Their names were Joseph and Benjamin. And he says to Joseph, I want you to head on up to Dothan, and I want you to take some supplies up to your brothers and this and that. And so he's heading up there. But when he gets up there, he finds that he's not well received by his brothers. And there was a reason for that. Joseph had a dream one time, just prior to all this. And in this dream, he dreamed that his family, if you will, and that's how the dream was interpreted, all bowed down before him. He dreamed that he was Barney Fife, and the whole world was in obedience to him. It was a dream where, the sun, moon, and the stars made obeisance to him. And it was a dream where the boys became subservient to him, the other sons. And so amongst themselves, and they knew that he was at this point daddy's boy. I mean, daddy loved Benjamin and Joseph. They were the favorites because they were the sons of his favorite wife, Rachel. And so there was a lot of jealousy among these brothers. And while they're up there, from a distance, they see him coming, and they begin to plot and plan, and they decide to kill their own brother. I mean, they're that angry at him. They're going to kill their own brother. And if it weren't for Reuben, the oldest brother, interceding, they would have killed him. As it turned out, they threw him down in a pit. And there is Joseph down there. I mean, Dad sent me down here to take care of you guys, you know, bring you some supplies and this and that, and you throw me down in the pit. And they wouldn't let him out. And next thing you know, Reuben turns his back, and some Ishmaelites come along who are getting ready to travel down into Egypt. And when they do, these guys sell their brother as a slave to these Ishmaelite traders. And these Ishmaelite traders, in turn, take Joseph down into Egypt, and they sell him to an Egyptian whose name was Potiphar, and he was an officer in Pharaoh's house. And the next thing you know, poor old Joseph, who just was sort of innocently doing what his dad told him to do, now finds himself in slavery in Egypt, separated from his family, and not a whole lot that he can do about it. But let me say this about Joseph. He was an extremely industrious young man. He was an individual. This is where they were actually selling him for money, and he's being taken off. When he got down into Egypt, he was the kind of individual that made sure everything was done right, was done on time. He was the kind of young man that caught your attention. And he did such an excellent job that he sort of, after a little while, became the head of Potiphar's house. And Potiphar just sort of entrusted him with everything. You run the show. Well, many of you know what took place after this. It was sort of a bad situation. Potiphar had a wife, and she cast her eyes upon this young man, Joseph, who had now taken over running the household. And I don't know what all was going through her mind, but one day she attempted to make a play on him, and he said, no way. And I guess it embarrassed her. Maybe she wasn't used to not getting her way. She was an important individual herself, being the wife of Potiphar, an officer in Pharaoh's government. And whatever the case, she didn't like what happened. And so she grabbed a hold of Joseph's, and she was going to force the issue. And this is like reverse sexual discrimination here or whatever, however you want to look at it. But Joseph fled for his life. He didn't want anything to do with this because regardless whether he may have been tempted or not, he knew that this would cost him his life if he allowed such a thing to happen. And I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt and believe that he just knew it was the righteous thing to do. And so he said no, and he fled from this situation. Well, that angered her even more, and so she then made up a story and said that he had come in and he had attacked her and he had attempted to rape her, if you will. And boy, that didn't set well with Potiphar. And of course, he believed his wife. And he took Joseph and he cast him into prison. And there's a great lesson in this. Did Joseph do anything wrong? Not at all. Matter of fact, you can't really find anything that he's done wrong from day one. The dream that he had was a legitimate dream. He didn't make it up. His father sent him there to take care of his brothers and take supplies to him. He did what he was told to do. And the series of events took place in his life that if all you did was isolate that event, you'd say, wow, nothing but bad is happening in this young man's life. He is sold into slavery. He has to make this long journey down into Egypt, and I'm sure that they didn't give him the most comfortable camel to ride on. And when he gets down there, he is sold again as a slave. He works for a couple years there, and the next thing you know, he's thrown into prison because somebody lied about him. And yet being, let's just say this, God does allow bad things to happen in our lives, even when we do right. He does that. He allows bad things, or at least things that we would interpret as being bad. He allows those things to happen in our life even when we haven't done anything. But there's always a reason. And there was a reason in this particular case as well. Another thing about Joseph. It doesn't matter what you do to a person that has character and has integrity. Their character and their integrity will remain, regardless of what you do to them. Joseph was a young man that had both of those attributes. As far as we know from the very beginning, he always was obedient in every way. And when he was cast into prison, I mean, it was that character and that integrity that made him the head of Potiphar's house. And when he was cast into prison, that same character and that same integrity, the 2 years that he was in prison, carried him. The next thing you know, he's down there sort of in charge of things in the prison as well. Just that kind of a class act individual. Well, one day, there's a couple guys there in prison with him. One is a butler and one is a baker. And they were men who worked in Pharaoh's house. I mean, he's the king of Egypt. And I don't know, they had done something to offend the king. And it didn't take much. I mean, back in those days, like I said, kings decided what was going to happen in other people's lives. And they didn't have to go get anybody's permission. These fellows were cast into prison. And they both had dreams. And I won't go into the details of the dreams. But Joseph interpreted their dreams because God gave him the interpretation. And he told them what their dreams meant. And sure enough, he said, one of you is going to die and the other one is going to be taken out of prison. And the one that was taken out of prison, it went exactly like Joseph said it was going to happen. And Joseph says, now when you get out of here, remember me, okay? But you know what? When he got out, he did not remember. He did not remember to tell anybody what Joseph had done. Well, time goes on. And then one day, this individual who was allowed to leave prison is working once again in Pharaoh's house. And he realizes or hears that Pharaoh has a dream. Pharaoh himself had one of these terrible nightmares. And it was one of those strange dreams where he dreamed about these seven skinny cows. I mean, that's really a weird dream, isn't it? Anybody ever dream about seven skinny cows before? And then seven fat cows and seven skinny cows eating seven fat cows? I mean, those are more like the kind of dreams I have. I have lots of nightmares and lots of things like that. But he dreamed about these corn stalks being thin and not having any fruit. And then he saw these other beautiful corn stalks. And he couldn't figure out what in the world this whole thing was about. About that time, the old butler remembered Joseph in prison and how he interpreted his dream. He tells Pharaoh, says, I know a guy that can give you the answer to that. And so they call for Joseph, and Joseph comes out. And of course, God is the one who interprets dreams, and he gave the glory to God. And then he told Joseph, or Pharaoh rather, exactly what his dream was. And that's quite a thing, sort of like what Daniel did, as I mentioned last Sunday night. He interprets this dream. Pharaoh is impressed, to say the least. And so about that time, Pharaoh takes Joseph and begins to promote him in the kingdom. In the meantime, there's some problems that are arising in the land of Israel. Of course, Joseph is down here in Egypt at this time. But back up in Israel, remember, Jacob is still up there with the other boys. The boys that had sold his son into slavery. They lied about what had happened to Joseph. They said he'd been killed by a wild beast. They even took that special coat of many colors that had been given to him, and they dipped it in blood and took it back to their father. I mean, they broke their father's heart. And so he's back there grieving with the other boys, sorrowful that his son Joseph is dead. But there's another problem brewing, and that is no rain. And the crops are drying up, and there's a famine in the land, and the people are getting hungry, and there's no place to go. And so they have to make a decision. Their decision is, there's plenty of food down in Egypt. We hear that there's food here, so let's make the journey down here and see if we can buy some food. Lo and behold, well, little did they know that Joseph was down there. The brothers assumed he was dead, and the father thought he was dead. They make the journey there to the land of Egypt. And when they get there, all of the brothers go except for Benjamin. Joseph, or Jacob rather, won't let Benjamin go. Because remember, he's the other son of Rachel. And he's already lost one of Rachel's boys, Joseph, in his mind. And he doesn't want to lose Benjamin. So he holds Benjamin to him. And he's the youngest son. And he's still very young at this time. In the meantime, the other sons go up there. Who is the second most powerful man in the kingdom at this time? He's a man of integrity. He's a man of character. He's the kind of individual that will succeed at anything he does. Because those attributes in a person's life will overcome any set of circumstances. You follow me? When you possess character and integrity, I don't care if you take a job as a janitor. You watch that individual rise and climb. It will happen. Those are two great things to have in your life. I don't care what you did with Joseph. He always found himself, sooner or later, moving up to the top. And there he was. He's the man in charge. He's the guy that's in charge. Because he has firmly established a relationship with God. And he's got this link with God. And that character and that integrity make him successful in everything he does. These boys have not seen Joseph for 20 years. He was young when they sold him into slavery. He's changed a lot in 20 years. He's now dressed in Egyptian garb, perhaps Egyptian makeup, and perhaps the 20 years, his facial features have changed somewhat. And when they go and stand before the man who is selling the food, they don't realize it, but the very man that they stand before is their brother Joseph. And Joseph, while he is not known to them, they are known to him. And he looks down at these boys and he realizes, wow, I got them right where I want them. They have no food. They come down here to buy food. We have food. They don't know who I am. I know who they are. Now, you could think that Joseph was being very devious in all this. But the fact is, even though he will play with their minds a little bit, and he does have fun with the situation. And he does torture them a little bit. When it's all done and said, he realizes that God allowed all of those negative things to happen in his life for one reason. So that God could use him to take care of his family. In spite of all the bad things they did to him, he still saw it as an opportunity for him to take care of his family. And so, like I said, he plays with their minds. They come in there and they want to buy some food. And he says, you know, where are you guys from? Oh, we're from up in Israel there in Canaan. He says, you're spies. You come here to spy out the land. And you know, they're going, what? You know, they didn't know what in the world he's talking about. You've come to spy out the land. And they're saying, no, we haven't. Next thing you know, he takes one of them and throws them in jail, Simeon. And Simeon's sitting there going, you know. And then, you know, they're talking back and forth, and these guys are giving their story. No, we live up here. Our father, his name's Jacob. He had 12 boys, and one of them is dead now. And, of course, they didn't know the one they're talking about standing before him, toying with him. And we've got one that's left at home, and that's his beloved son. And he sent us down here to get food, and this thing's going back and forth. And Joseph says, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to put this guy in jail. If your story is really true, I want you to go back and get that other son that's left up there, that one you called Benjamin, you bring him down here. Oh boy, you're talking about striking a chord. Because they knew that Jacob was not going to turn loose of Benjamin. And so they begin to negotiate and all this. Bottom line of it is they have to head back and they tell their dad. They said, you know what, Dad? Simeon is in jail and he's going to stay there till Benjamin comes. And Jacob says, well, then he can just sit there because I'm not going to give you Benjamin. And you know what? I don't know if you read that text, but they wait a long time before they go back. Simeon sits in jail, I figure at least a couple years. Just sitting there. It's a long time before they head back. They didn't go back until the food they bought ran out. And when it ran out, they headed back because they didn't have a choice. The famine was going to be for 7 years. And so they travel back, and when they get there, Benjamin comes along, and he begins to toy with them again. They go and they buy their food, and they're getting ready to leave. And next thing you know, they stop, and they find their money is back in their seed sacks. And they're going, oh no, what is our money doing in here? We paid already for this food. Pharaoh's going to think that we stole this food and stole our money back. He's going to kill us. So they go back, and they're trying to make up stories. This thing's going on and on and on. Joseph's just having a blast with this. I mean, I just see him sitting in his chambers by himself. Man, this is great. He's laughing, carrying on. He's sitting down figuring out what I'm going to do to him next. He's got him right where he wants him. And then finally they come in and he gives them more food and then he sends it back and then he takes one of his silver drinking cups there and he hides it, has it hidden in Benjamin's sack. And then the brothers take off again and then all of a sudden they turn around behind him. Here comes Pharaoh's guys and they're chasing after them. They go, what have we done? What have we done? You know? And they start ripping open their sacks and sure enough, Benjamin stole something from Pharaoh's household. And I mean, they're going, no, he didn't. I say, you boys are going to jail for this, for sure, this time. And they're going, no, why you can't. And they're thinking, how in the world could this happen? How could it happen? Of all the kids, why did it have to be Benjamin? Joseph's having a blast. I mean, he's just enjoying this thing thoroughly. Well, they go back, and then here's poor old Reuben. He's pleading with Joseph. He's saying, look, he says, you know, he doesn't know who he is. He's saying, look, our father's going to die. He will literally die if we don't bring this boy home. Now, I'll give you my two sons if that's what it takes, but I have to take this boy back. Reuben had some bad things in his life, but there were a few good things too. Well, make a long story short. Finally, Joseph brings them all in. He sits them down at a table, and he did something real strange. Caused them to mumble among themselves for quite some time. He arranged them according to ages. And there was no way for him to know that. I mean, being who he was. But as it turned out, being who he was, he did know their ages. And they're sitting there, and he leaves the room, and they're sitting there going, how'd he do that? What's going on? Did you guys tell him who the oldest was? I don't care. I want to know what's going on. And they're sitting there talking among themselves. And finally, he comes back in. And it's time. And he stands before them. You're talking about an emotional moment. He stands before them. And he says, gentlemen, I am your brother Joseph. And you're talking about jaws dropping. Teeth falling out. You know. Fear in their eyes. He's the second most powerful man in Egypt, and Egypt is the most powerful empire in the world at this time. He's the second most powerful man on earth, and he's the son that they had sold into slavery, and he now stands before them, and they realize he has been toying with us. He is now going to kill us. And Joseph, that wasn't his intent at all. As a matter of fact, when he revealed himself to them, he was so emotionally overcome, he had to go off into a room and he just broke down and began to sob and cry and sob and cry. He's being reunited with his family. They're looking at it that they're going to be separated for eternity because they're all going to die. But in Joseph's mind, I've seen my family again. And there's Benjamin. So after he reveals himself, he sends him, you know, with all the stuff. But he's trying to negotiate a deal to keep Benjamin with him. But the fact is, before it's all done, what they end up doing, they go back and they travel up in here and they go to Jacob and they say, "Dad, we have some good news for you. That is, your son Joseph is alive, and he wants you and all of us to come down, and they're going to give us some land down here until this famine is over, and we can raise our crops and raise our families." And Jacob, of course, he just was overcome by this whole thing. Well, anyway, they end up traveling down to that land. They settle into a land called the Land of Goshen, which is located here in this region, right over in this area here. Even to this day, down south, that is a slang phrase, Land of Goshen, you know. But that's where it comes from in the Bible. And they settle in, and things are going real well for a while. Their families are multiplying, and eventually they will become a very, very large group of people. But in the meantime, and by the way, I should show you the slide where he reveals himself to his brothers. And there's just a little bit of fear going on there with those fellas. But they journey down into Egypt. Pharaoh get an opportunity to meet Jacob eventually. And Joseph will have a couple of sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And they will eventually be blessed by Jacob. And the family will expand. And eventually Jacob will grow old and he will die. In his latter days, he was a patriarch. In his latter days, he was a great man in the same sense that Abraham was a great man and Isaac was a great man. It took a long time for Jacob to get there. If you study his life from his conniving, supplanting days to the days when he stood as a patriarch before Pharaoh, a lot has happened in his life. He's well over 100 years of age, and God has blessed him abundantly. I believe Jacob, if I'm not mistaken, was 147 years old when he died. But at this point, there's a little gap in history. And for the next years, matter of fact, nearly 400 years, the nation of Israel will really expand, or the group that we should call the seed of Isaac will continue to expand there in the land of Egypt. And in that land of Goshen that I pointed out a few moments ago, they will continue to the point where they become a threat to the Egyptians. As a matter of fact, at the time period that I'm speaking of, when these new problems are going to arise, the Jews are at least 2 million strong in the land of Egypt. In 400 years, they have really multiplied and replenished, haven't they? And they're nearly 2 million strong, and that's a conservative figure. And it's to the point where the Egyptians are saying, "Wait a minute, these people are taking over our land." Now, I'm just going to throw something in here, and I don't know if it's absolutely correct, but I think that it is. When they eventually, when they went down into the land of Egypt because there was a famine in the land, that famine was only to last 7 years. And they went down there to be taken care of during that famine. There's no indication that I can see of that God ever intended for them to stay in Egypt. And had they left, after the famine was over, back to the land that God had promised Isaac, and they already had that promise, that land was given to them, what took place here would not have taken place. The Egyptians took these Israelites, these children of Israel, whose Jacob's name was changed to Israel, and they made slaves of them. And I'm telling you, they mistreated them badly. And they would make them go out and try to take straw and clay and make bricks with it. And there wasn't enough straw. And the fact is, the worse the conditions got, the more they were beaten. And it was just a very, very, very difficult situation for the nation of Israel during this time. And the hard taskmasters would beat them openly and very, very difficult. And in the meantime, there was a little baby that was born, His name was Moses. And the Egyptians had made a decision. We are using these Israelites as slaves, but they're going to overcome our country. So let's do this to stop this. Let's kill all of the male children that are born. We'll take the female children. We can incorporate them into our society. But let's kill all of the male children. And that was the decision that they made. Now, don't ever take for granted the blessings of living in the United States of America in the time and age that you do. Most of us can't even comprehend what it would be like for someone to break into the doors of our house and steal our children and kill them. But that's what was happening all across the land of Israel. And this mother in particular, she decided to take her child and put it in a little bulrush basket that had been made here and put him in the river. And then she sort of sat back and waited until Pharaoh's daughter shows up and finds this baby as she goes down to the river to wash. And the little baby, his name is Moses. And God was preparing a deliverer for the nation of Israel, a man that would deliver them from bondage, a man that would become a great man in the history of Israel, a man that would prove himself as a man of valor, a man of character, a man of compassion. He was a great pastor to the people that God gave him, and he's a great example of how a pastor should conduct himself. And this man, Moses, whose life will continue next week, is one that will deliver the nation of Israel from the bondage of Egypt, will take them out eventually into the wilderness, and then eventually they will be led further into the promised land under the leadership of Joshua. God has great plans for the nation of Israel. He has great plans for Moses. He has great plans for his people. But I guess, once again, as a reminder, over and over we see this principle and we see this great truth. From the very beginning, as God created Adam and Eve, and he gave them the perfect environment, and things seemed to go awry, and next thing you know, they were cast out of the garden. So God says, let's start over with Noah. And so they did, and he gave him a fresh start, and things went awry. And God says, let's start with Abraham, and we'll bring forth a great nation from Abraham, and I'll bless him. And things, you know, they find themselves down in Egypt in bondage. Life is a series of cycles, isn't it? And it just seems to roll over from the positive back into the negative for a while, and then it rolls back over into the positive. That statement is true not only of history, but it's true of your individual lives. Not notice that. I mean, you even have the short cycles, the good days and the bad days. And then you have the good weeks and the bad weeks. And then, boy, we had a couple of good months. And then you have a couple of bad months. And sometimes the cycles are in years. Yeah, we had a couple of bad years there in business. Yeah, we had a couple of good years in business. And sometimes it's decades in our lives. But life is a cycle. Cycle of, and this is the book of Ecclesiastes that Pastor Grace has been preaching on. It's a series of events that take you from the negative into the positive, from the negative into the positive, from the negative into the positive. And all of it is a part of the learning process. And you don't even have to do anything bad to have negative hit in your life. It's not so bad to live in the negative. It really isn't. I'm not getting ready to slam Larry Wade. I promise I'm going to let him go tonight. I love Larry. But the fact is, there are a lot of very negative things that do happen in our lives. And it's okay. It's okay that Joseph was in prison. That's okay. God had a plan. He had a plan. It's okay that, this little baby had to grow up under the circumstances that he did, where somebody had to hide him away. God had a plan. God's got a plan. Andy always had a plan. Barney never had a clue. God's got a plan. You and I, a lot of times, we just don't have a clue. We don't have a clue. And we get so depressed and so down because things don't go exactly the way we think they should or the way that we would like for them to. God has a plan. And what comes around goes around. I mean, it's just everything's in a big cycle. Don't worry. Things will turn around in time. Give it a day. Give it a week. Give it a month. Give it a year. Give it a lifetime. At the end of your lifetime, things are going to turn around pretty good, aren't they? It's okay. God's got a plan. You are where you are. Be like Paul. Learn to be content in whatsoever state you know you're in. I mean, it's okay. God knows. He's got a plan. Why don't you stand with me real quick, and we'll have a word of prayer, and we'll close here tonight. We'll pick it up next week with the life of Moses. Series of events that will take place in his life, and we'll take you through the wilderness, and we'll take you into the promised land, and we'll take you as far as we can next week, Lord willing. We're going to bow our heads in just a moment. We're going to have a word of prayer in just a moment. Some have questioned, why is it you don't give an invitation on Wednesday night in these particular series of lessons? And the answer for that is this. You don't have to give an invitation every time. We haven't really presented the gospel, although there's a tremendous amount of truth that's been presented. It's okay to not have an invitation. It's okay for you to take information and let it sink in. Have a week to think about it, mull it over. It's okay to contemplate, to meditate, as Larry was saying earlier, to stop and to think. Let God do something in your life. And when the time is right, you'll know it. So let's pray. Our Father, we do thank you, Lord, for this opportunity. I pray, Heavenly Father, that you bless the time we spent together. Let the words be real and true in the hearts and lives of those who have heard them here tonight. Encourage us to be the best Christians that we can be to bring honor and glory to the name of Christ. Help us, Father, in understanding the Word of God, that the book will become more precious to us. We'll fall in love with this blessed book and learn to live it as well as read it. Be doers of the Word, not hearers only. We ask these things in the name of Christ our Savior. Amen. God bless you and have a great evening.